Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Positive Education Podcast. My name is Ash Manuel, and I'm super excited to be joined today by Lisa, who's director of Rainbow Hollow. Now, Rainbow Hollow is a truly amazing organisation. It provides a lot of services, particularly for people with neurodiversity and also psychosocial challenges, and that includes young people. Lisa mentions in the episode about how they work with people from as young as 2 years of age, through to people within their 50s as well. Today's main focus, though, is on young people in schools, so in the classrooms, because I know that there are teachers who have neurodiverse students within their classrooms, and it can be quite challenging. So Lisa is a great person to talk to about this. 30-plus years of experience, not only 30-plus years of experience in the area, but lived experience as well. I think that's really important. And she's really passionate about educating educators on how to teach young people with neurodiversity. And she gives some fantastic tips on how to do that, but also some fantastic tips for addressing burnout for teachers as well. And we go into that today. So it's definitely worth a listen. There's going to be a lot of takeaways for school leaders as well as teachers, as well as teachers. So really excited for this episode. So without further ado, we'll get into it. Lisa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me today, Ash.
Absolute pleasure. And I really want to have you come on because I'm really interested in what you're doing in terms of Rainbow Hollow and what the purpose is and I guess what you're aiming to achieve. And I found it really interesting when I was reading about what you're doing and I'd love to hear a bit more about it. So if you could first share a bit about your background and what inspired you to start Rainbow Hollow, and I guess what's the driving force behind creating a space where all people are treated as equals?
Absolutely. As somebody who's not only worked in the industry for nearly 30 years, I've also got two children with complex disabilities. So our journey has been tough navigating the space of the NDIS and funding and supports. And I certainly didn't always feel treated as an equal, and I know that they didn't either. So after years of working for directors who either, you know, didn't have the same passion that I did for vulnerable people or knowledge or both, I decided it was time to head out and create a space that I thought was missing in the sector.
Absolutely. And what were some of those things that, I guess without being too harsh on anybody else, what are some of those things that I guess you saw that could be done better?
Yeah, I guess, look, there are a lot of people that go into the NDIS space, I think, that see it as an easy dollar, an easy way to make money. It's also an area and a space where, you know, the learning side of things is offered readily and on a very cheap basis. So to study, to be part of the industry, you know, is a very short course at a very low cost. So it doesn't always necessarily attract people that have a passion for this area or that, you know, potentially have lived experience or those type of things. It can sometimes attract people that are after a quick buck, which yep. results in vulnerable people not, you know, necessarily being treated as equals. And, you know, that's not always the case. There are some amazing people in this industry, especially in Adelaide. You know, I've met and liaised with so many amazing people who, you know, share exactly the same, you know, thoughts and values that I do. But unfortunately, like every industry, you know, there are people in it that aren't necessarily there for the right reasons.
Yeah, totally get what you're saying. It's so good how you've, I guess, got that passion for it and with your children and with your what you mentioned before about yourself. Well, that's so good that you've actually created something to try to solve that problem and help other people as well. And what sort of some of the services that Rainbow Hollow offer?
We offer in-home support. We offer transport, appointments, gardening service. We have a trauma practitioner on board. We have things like going to start your NDIS journey, so we can assist people free of charge to navigate putting in access to get a plan, and then explaining to them exactly what that plan means and breaking it down, which unfortunately people are getting handed plans every day and they really don't have any idea what to do with them. So that's also a service that we offer.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I mean, I don't have too much experience with the NDIS, but I heard it can get quite confusing and people aren't sure what they can access over there. So there's a lot of different services that you provide. And I guess the main people who you do look after is supporting young people. And I guess, as you said, mentioned about specialised like mentoring and support for neurodiverse young people and those facing psychosocial challenges. So they're some of those people that you support. So can you, I know that you shared some things there, but maybe I guess I know that you've got a lot of volunteers and mentors. So can you share some of the ways that the team helps young people navigate life's challenges? Like what are some of those sessions that you do with the young people specifically?
Yeah. So I guess the one thing that we stand out, well, that I feel that we stand out from a crowd is that my mentors are handpicked. I employ for the participants' needs and I will not hire mentors who don't have some type of lived experience. And that lived experience could be, you know, lived family member experience, lived self experience or strong friendship connections. People may have complexities or struggles. So they've seen it, they've dealt with it, they know how it feels. Many of our mentors have fantastic talents. We have singer songwriters on board, we have filmmakers, we have spiritual guiders, we have people that have a love for surfing, and so many other talents. And that assists our participants to reach their goals by positive role modeling. So we can assist people throughout their journey, grow and achieve, which is, you know, a fairly cliche line. But I feel that Rainbow Hollow honor that commitment and we actually follow through and ensure that people, you know, people's lives are being impacted and that we're making a difference. We assist clients who have addiction issues, homelessness, complex family issues, job seeking. But mostly, you know, we support their bad days as well as their good. You know, so we're seeing both sides of the coin. And we, you know, we the bottom line is we make sure people know their self-worth.
And it's so important. I think it's so, as you made a great point about you handpick the mentors because they have had a lived experience, and I think that's so important. And like, for I mean, you can, I mean, people can work with others, but sometimes it might be hard to relate. But having that lived experience and maybe being similar, that young person, I guess, can see, well, I'm going through some struggles at the moment, but I can get through it because my mentor has had that. Is that, well, I guess that's one of the things.
Absolutely. And you know, relatability is, you know, something that draws us to other people. If you can relate to their life journey or, you know, their cause, you can generally build a relationship. And that's the really big part about this is it's not about just putting somebody into a job to care for somebody else. It's about growing a relationship, nurturing it, fostering it, and ensuring that, you know, they are a good match. And if they're not, then you look for somebody that is. You don't make it happen just because, you know, I'm paying you to mentor somebody, go and mentor somebody. You know, I want to know that the participant's getting something out of this.
And I want to talk about, I guess, what teachers, like some strategies like teachers can use in a minute, but what sort of, like when a mentor works with a young person, what's an example of like a session or some time they might spend together? What happens in that time?
So in that time, one of the things you will hear throughout this industry is choice and control. So the client has full choice and control over their decisions and what they do. Generally, not everybody's good at making those decisions or thinking of the things that they might like to do. So, you know, sometimes it's offering options. You know, perhaps today we could do this, 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 and this. Or Sometimes it's planning ahead. Hey, next week, why don't we go and catch this movie? You know, you've been talking about it for a really long time and, you know, you've wanted to see it. Maybe that's what we should do with our Access community time this week coming up. Or it could be things like assisting them with swimming lessons, cooking lessons, you know, anywhere that's a safe space that they're achieving their goals. And their goals could be anything from, you know, building community connections. So it could be, you know, taking them to a youth group, those sorts of spaces where they wouldn't necessarily wander in on their own. But they feel like they've got somebody that's relatable next to them that is kind of their safe person, I guess, to be able to explore those options that they probably wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah, that's so good. I love that. And given that, I guess that that choice, the ownership of what they want to do, that's really important as well, rather than being told what to do. So they get to explore those passions, but also, yeah, things that they're interested in as well, and instead of like other people assuming what they want to do, which sometimes can happen. Now, I just want to move on, Lisa. So I know that you like work with young people. So with that young person, when we're talking about, what ages are we talking about? What's sort of the age, I guess, bracket that you work with?
2 to 56.
As in 2 years of age?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yep.
A beautiful set of two-year-old twins.
Fantastic.
On the board, yes.
Yep, yep. And I guess because it's a positive education podcast, this one, and majority of listeners are teachers or educators. And I think from what I've seen, being a teacher myself and then have been doing Growing with Gratitude for the last 11 years, I think many teachers who work with neurodiverse students, they may not always know how to best support them. So can you share some ideas about some key things educators should understand about neurodiversity and maybe some strategies that they could use in the classroom?
Absolutely. So often we see in this space with teachers and schools that they strive so hard to be inclusive that they're actually not.
Right.
You know, we can all put that we're inclusive on our website. Following that through is a different matter altogether.
Yep.
Sometimes, you know, they seem to disregard the person's ability to take on and process information. You know, we deliver information in grey terms a lot of the time. Neurodiverse people, they need a very black and white terminology. And teachers must be able to read the room, you know, and pick the blank faces to explore those students, break it down to them. Common thing I hear so much is that teachers will say, but they didn't tell me, but I didn't know, they didn't reach out, or they didn't come and talk to me. A neurodiverse person, I cannot stress this enough, they will not come to the teacher. They will not put themselves in the limelight. They will not put their hand up. They don't want to bring attention to themselves. So they need check-ins. They need the teacher to check in. You know, so it needs to be flagged that these kids do have a learning difficulty or neurodiversity or mental health, so that the teachers are checking in at the end of the session. Did you understand everything today? Is there anything that I can help you out with? And I know that that might be going over and beyond the 55-minute scope of the lesson. But if they only knew the importance of that question, it's so important that they need to reach out.
Absolutely. And I guess sometimes, like, the teachers aren't aware of that, though. Like, they might not actually realise. So in a way, it's really important that the leaders of a school really help or go down the path of training teachers I guess, how to teach students with neurodiversity. Can you just explain for those who aren't sure how would you describe neurodiversity or what comes under neurodiversity?
So neurodiversity, there's a fairly large umbrella.
Yeah.
It can be autism, ADHD, acquired brain injuries, intellectual disabilities, and everything in those spaces.
Yep.
So, you know, you'll hear the words neurodiverse, neurodivergent, it's people that fit under that umbrella.
Yeah, I understand. And I guess, I mean, you mentioned a couple of different ones like autism, ADHD. They come under the neurodiversity umbrella, but I guess they might have their different, I guess, ways of how teachers need to, what's the word I'm looking for? Not react,
intervene.
Engage. Engage with them. So again, it's like, I guess it's talking to someone like yourself, also parents if they are in a situation where they can be helpful as well, but also getting professionals in to help with that. And I think it's so important, and I think it's getting better, but I think there's still a lot of room for it, room for improvement in this area, because as you say, like, we say that we're inclusive, but often it doesn't happen, and it can be like a sign on the wall, and that's about it. And that goes for a lot of things.
I would love to agree, Ash. I would love to agree.
But it's not getting better.
Unfortunately, a lot of the young people that we look after, I'm not seeing that it's getting better. I'm seeing them talk the talk. I just am not seeing them walk the walk.
Got you. Yep.
And it's disappointing. It really is disappointing. Saddening.
Yeah. So, what do you think? What if you, I guess, had a magic wand, mm-hmm. and what would you do? What's the first thing that, first thing that you would do to hopefully make this better?
Well, I think there's a number of things. I guess definitely all teachers must be trained in those areas, not just the inclusion teachers that are based at each school.
Yep.
And everything comes from leadership. So all leadership need to be trained. Mm. And I'm not talking let's go to a one-day seminar. I'm talking extensively trained.
Yep.
Building rapport, trust and connection, knowing the student, not knowing their name on a roll or knowing that they have ASD level 2 written next to their name. Creating a safe space which is actually truly safe. And that's a really difficult task in itself. Mm. Listening and not talking is probably the best way that they can build rapport, and truly listen to what a young person is telling you. I think a lot of times people think they're making excuses for their behavior, or, they're only telling me that because, I caught them out or they did something wrong. But truly listen to what is actually happening for that young person. And that might not be an instantaneous thing. That could be taking it away and breaking it down and going, okay, I'm looking at the patterns of behavior and who's around that person when it happens and those sorts of things. Mm. But also bullying is a massive issue everywhere, but particularly in Adelaide schools. I've seen and witnessed a lot of it. And there needs to be serious consequences for people that are bullying, so that neurodiverse young people feel safe to go to the school and that they're represented and advocated for by other adults. And that doesn't happen. Mm. You did the wrong thing, go to timeout, internal suspension, external suspension. They're not getting to the crux of why did this happen? But I think communicating and listening to the parents, because nobody knows their child like a parent.
Yep.
And I think sometimes that doesn't really happen. It's more here's a letter to take home and get signed to say that this is the consequence you had for this bad behavior, which is not actually necessarily a bad behavior.
Mm. Yes, I know what you mean, yeah.
So I think it's those things that, could be helpful. And I think, back in 5-7 years ago, they had in-school psychologists who did things like placement hours. And I know as a parent who had a child with mental health struggles in high school that the weekly and fortnightly psychology appointment was so helpful. She was on site and she understood the demographics of the school and, my child felt heard and understood. She also became that kind of buffer between him and leadership. If there was issues that were unresolved or friendship issues or those things that, he felt like he had another adult advocating for him who could see his point of view. So that's really important too. But, you know, obviously people like yourself, you know, going into schools and educating people on these issues, that in itself, you know, is very highly regarded by somebody like myself. I would love to see you, you know, thousands of you in all of, you know, all schools across the country. There'd be nothing better. You cannot educate people enough.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think, the reason why I started like growing with gratitude is because as an adult, I came across some skills based on gratitude and empathy, kindness and self-awareness, and realized you can actually practice them. Yeah. And I started to practice them as an adult. And while I was teaching, like it was one of those bit of a co thing where it came about where I thought, well, I wish I learned this when I was like in primary school. And then, I guess our school at the time at Emmanuel Primary School where I was teaching, and we wanted to do a well-being program. This is back in about 2013, but we weren't really sure what to do. And to the school's credit, they were quite early adopters in this space, but nothing had really happened after that first year. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those moments where I thought, I reckon I can come up with something that can really help teachers teach these skills, but most importantly for the students to learn them. And it's a practice, it's a skill. So the more we give the opportunity for young people to practice, the better off they're going to be. It's like just that consistency. It's like any skill. The more we do it, the better we get. It's one of those key things. But no, I appreciate that. And I totally get where you're coming from. I think that you make a really good point. I don't know. I know that there's the inner schools now, particularly, I'm not sure about high schools too much, but in primary schools, there might be a well-being person, but they're not a psychologist, and they get pulled around to so many areas of the school in a day that they're just putting out fires a lot of the time.
That's right.
And they can't really implement something sustainable. So that's definitely a thing that I've definitely noticed in schools in the last, particularly the last couple of years.
Yeah. Now, and sadly, you know, that would come down to funding issues.
Exactly. It does. Yes.
In all government departments is something that's an issue. So, you know, I also understand and take that on board, but you know, I attended a Mental Health Coalition roundtable in late 2023, and I think the biggest thing I took away from it is that early intervention's the key. So we need to start educating people younger. And I think you just said exactly the same thing. You wish you knew about it in primary school.
Yeah.
But I firmly, personally believe that mental health should be a core subject, because I can guarantee that you would use those skills and those tools much more than you'd ever use something like a language. You know, how often are we using German or French? But we're teaching it.
Yeah.
But if we were to teach, you know, inclusion, diversity, mental health, trauma, and people actually understood it from, you know, we're starting high school now at year 7. So, you know, somewhere between the age of 11 and 13. If we started there rather than when people are leaving school at 17, 18, 19, you know, and then we're looking at education, further education in those spaces, it's all too late. These people have already had a horrific journey, you know, trying to navigate high school with bullies and, you know, but if everybody had this opportunity to have this learning, would we see as many bullies? Would we see as many people that were ignorant to the needs of neurodiverse people or people with trauma? Would people know how to identify it a little bit better? You know, great, they can go to Germany and speak German once in their lifetime, maybe twice. But this is a tool that they could use every day and put into action every single day.
Absolutely. And I know one school, Kimmon Park Primary School, a few years ago now, they went down the path of creating it as a special subject, like PE, like a language, like you just mentioned, but they do have that as a subject. And not all school, as you say, it's very rare that happens. And in the Growing with Gratitude book that I I do a bit of case study about Kim and
yes,
Park.
Yes, I have
and,
a copy.
Yeah, excellent, fantastic. Yeah, Kim and Park and how Desi Pantelis, her name is. She is the teacher, and they go to the room each week. Each class has a time slot each week, or maybe a couple times a week. Plus, she supports the classroom teachers as well, and they get a lot of mental well-being practice in their days. And I guess one of the goals, and I love to see it, is, as you said before, like it be a mainstream, like, well, just everyone does it basically. So at the moment it's quite patchy in schools. Like some schools will do, like, have a focus like on like a particular day, you know how you have World Kindness Day and these world days, which is nice, but it's not consistent enough.
And it's once a term.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And are we teaching them anything on those days, or are we just letting them dress in different colours? You know, there's got to be something behind it. You know, but, and I guess on the flip side of that as well, without the funding that assists these sorts of programs along, and, you know, the extra wellbeing teachers and those things, the risk of burnout to those teachers that are there, and leadership, counsellors and SSOs, because, you know, let's face it, the SSOs are kind of in the front line of all of this, in the first instance. So, you know, that funding also, you know, could be there to further support their well-being, because burnout is huge, not only for, you know, carers that are dealing with their own children or a family member, but also in schools and in workplaces across the country. You know, it is very, very easy to be burnt out dealing with other people's issues day in, day out. It really is. So, you know, that's a huge thing to consider as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what I've learned over the last few years is how many unbelievable people there are in society, like support workers, teachers as well, but mainly, like, I'm just talking about support workers here who spend so much time with these young people who really do need the assistance, but pretty much sacrifice their own lives to make a difference for someone else. And they're the real heroes. Like, I mean, we've got emergency services, but these support people who not many people hear about, like, I've come to realize over the last few years that these, like, people deserve, like, medals. They really do.
Yeah, I agree with you that they're not recognised enough, and they tend to seemingly wander into the limelight only in the negative times. But the positive times aren't recognised, and there are some amazing support workers out there, some amazing mentors that do, you know, go way over and beyond in their job roles. You know, and they don't finish with the client at 3 o'clock and go, right, that's it. You know, they follow things through. They are forever advocating for them and, you know, teaching them new tools. And I often explain to my workers particularly, it's all about building your toolbox. And if you think about it in a mechanic term, if you buy yourself a toolbox, it needs to be filled. And there's so many different things that you need it in there to fix a car. So, you know, a screwdriver, a ratchet, you know, so many. You will not get all of those tools working with one client. But as you progress into different spaces with different participants, you can take tools away and put them in your toolbox. And you'll know when you need to open your toolbox and get them out. In this case, I need a screwdriver. And that might be a really basic way of, you know, of breaking it down. And people may see that as a you know, an unhuman-related way to explain it. But I tried to explain it in a very black and white way, where there is no gray areas. And everybody knows what a toolbox is and, you know, that cars need fixing. So, you know, filling up your toolbox is about spending time with these people, advocating for them and learning things along the way. And, you know, that's something that only time and experience, you know, can help fill that toolbox. It's not something that we're born with. We're none of us are born with a full toolbox.
Yep, totally agree. Absolutely. And I guess that's the same. And that, I mean, you mentioned, touched on it before, Lisa, but I just wanted to, like, you talked about the burnout. And I guess that's the thing as well that you mean by a toolbox. Like, teachers need these tools to be able to cope during challenging situations, because it doesn't matter where you teach or what context is in, there's going to be challenges, whether that's for different reasons, but there are challenges that come up. It just comes with the teaching role. So it's really important that, and I'm really a big believer in this, and I've spoken with lots of principals about this as well, but having those, like, taking responsibility for yourself to come up with those things to put in your toolbox that you know that will work for you. And you don't know unless you actually try, as you said. Like, you need to, it's not going to happen overnight. You just need these experiences to find out what works for you. And when you find out something, well, that's when you put in your toolbox and say, okay, if this happens, I know this worked for me. And like a simple one is like physical activity. So for me, I know now, well, really aware of it, that if I'm having a bit of a bad day, if I do physical activity, that's going to make me feel better.
Yeah.
And I know I'm very self-aware, and I've got some other things as well, but that's definitely the number one. Now, just with the, I guess the, just think from an educator's point of view, like supporting students, particularly those with complex needs, can be, I guess, emotionally demanding for educators and support workers and families as well. But, you know, I guess from an educator point of view, teacher, what advice would you give teachers to protect their own well-being while continuing to provide the best support for their students?
Yeah. I mean, I could say leave school at school, but realistically, our brains don't function like that. Mm. So I would say debriefing with someone who understands the space is a must. A colleague, counsellor, someone in the leadership team. Journaling is also a super helpful way to get closure.
Yes.
And to put your feelings down. Disengaging at times, if you're overwhelmed, is a better, much better option than doing the job with half the understanding or half the care factor. Sometimes disengagement is the best possible way. And if you're dealing in a space, and you know that it's just going back and forward with a certain student, disengaging and potentially, you know, somebody else coming in and sort of, you know, taking a step out can be a really good solution. But I think the big key areas that I think are important is they must do something for themselves every day. I call it self-soothing and recharge. It could be as simple as eating your favorite food, ordering takeaway, having a massage, having a bath, watching trashy reality TV, whatever assists someone to switch off and refocus.
Yep.
Is highly important. And you will have people argue, oh, but I don't have time for that. I have a very large family. I am a director of a business. I have 3 volunteer roles that I also assist with. Make time. It can be 5 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever it takes. But most of all, in the school setting, they got to demand support from leadership. Don't let them shy away from giving you the support that you deserve, because it happens.
Yep, absolutely. No, I love those tips. They're great ones. And I think journaling is an underrated one. I've got stacks of journals that I've gone through over the years and carry about on me for different purposes, like for ideas, to just debriefing and like just getting things off your chest. Like ones for having like what, yeah, best parts about your day and things like that. And just, I think it's such a powerful thing, because I know there's like the science behind like having it in your brain and putting it down on paper. That's quite an effective, I guess, a tool, tool to be able to call on. But the other, yeah, I totally agree with that as well. Like, disengaging.
It's also an amazing way to track your journey.
Mm.
So, you know, you can refer back to it and go, okay, this is how I was feeling 3 months ago. I'm now dealing with exactly the same student with exactly the same diagnosis and the same issues, but look at how I've dealt with it today.
Absolutely.
No, so you can track your progress that way.
Yep, well. Absolutely. No, I totally agree with that. And I think, I mean, that's a great way to finish our conversation today with those tips for teachers. And at the end of the day, like, you can, like, I guess, go through those challenges and get yourself down and can spiral out of control. But it's that self-awareness and taking that ownership. And you mentioned some great tips there, because those ideas are great, but unless you actually do it, it's not going to be useful. So as I said before, like, educators, we know what we're getting ourselves in for. Like, hopefully we're going to have lots of good days and not as many bad ones, but there are going to be challenges that come up. And just having those tools to, it's like preventative measure. Like, if this happens, I know that this will work for me. And those ideas are like journaling, disengagement, doing something for yourself. They're also important, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree, Ash.
Excellent, Lisa. Well, really appreciate your time, and I've learned so much today. And I'm sure that other people who will be listening will learn so much. And I know that Rainbow Hollow have got a website, and it's got a lot of information on there about what you do. And also, it's got, I reckon last time I looked, it had a lot of your mentors on there as well. So it's got some mentor profiles. So lots of information there, and to find out a bit more about what Rainbow Hollow does. So really appreciate the time, Lisa, and thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed my time.